I would like to welcome you to another in the series of centennial lectures put on by the University of Illinois in this 100th year of her anniversary. I really feel as if this is my second chance to introduce Dean Pollack. He spoke yesterday in the law school auditorium at 11 o'clock to an overflow audience of enthusiastic law students on the Powell affair, and at the last minute, no one had shown up to introduce him. I was standing outside talking to him, wondering who was going to do the honors, and it was clear that the dean of the law school was going to do that, but finally he arrived a few minutes late, a little out of breath. I said, "What kept you?" He said, "Well, we just got the university budget." And he said, "Even the dean of the Yale Law School has to wait till I open that and see how much money there's going to be for the faculty next year. First things first, in all cases." Speaking of the dean of the law school, I was at Western Reserve 2 weeks ago and was introduced there as the dean expectant of the University of Illinois Law School. There was the appropriate pregnant pause there afterward. And then somebody said in a very low voice, "They'll call him worse things than that before very much longer," which I suppose is the lot of all deans. The 75th anniversary of Western Reserve was the reason that I happened to be in Cleveland, and they gave an honorary degree to the dean of the Harvard Law School, Dean Griswold. We are not going to do quite that well by our speaker tonight, but I am sure that what we will hear from the dean of the Yale Law School will be at least the equivalent of what we heard from the dean of the Harvard Law School in Cleveland. In any case, the ties are very close because our speaker this evening is a graduate of Harvard College. For some reason or other, however, he decided to go to a sister institution and attended the Yale Law School. If this sounds like a rather conventional career, it proceeded along those same conventional lines in the fact that he then became a law clerk, which is almost the standard pattern for a good Ivy League law school professor and dean. He was law clerk for Mr. Justice Rutledge, one of the great civil libertarians of the court. He followed this by a stint with the State Department, where he worked with another great law teacher, Philip Jessup. He followed this by practice with a distinguished New York law firm of Paul, Weiss, Rifkin, Garrison, and so forth. And up to this point, you might think, well, this is just another in the mold of distinguished lawyers produced by Ivy League law schools. But he departs from the pattern considerably at this point. And when you understand that, among other things, he went to Mississippi and marched in the Selma marches, and that he has been deeply devoted to the cause of civil rights, you realize that this is no ordinary man. He has taught at the Yale Law School for a number of years and has recently been burdened with the problems of administration at that school, and I'm not so sure whether he's here to give us a centennial lecture or whether he is here to get away from the problems of administration at Yale. But in any case, he has a fascinating topic, and I must not spend any longer in the introduction. He's going to speak on democracy and the Constitution, the century past, and the years ahead. Dean Pollack.
Thank you very much, Professor Krivit. I assure you that I think I did sense the not too carefully veiled promise that was connoted by your introduction, that depending upon my performance, I might get an honorary degree, though that seems unlikely. But if not, Dean Sullivan may be willing to part with a portion of next year's law school budget for the assistance of a school which needs whatever technical assistance may be forthcoming out of the socialist coffers of a great state university. A century ago, first by combat and then by constitutional amendment, the people of the United States adopted new national purposes and changed the structure of their federation in order to carry out those purposes. Men and women who had been chattels were denominated citizens, both of the states in which they lived and of the Union. And they and all persons residing within the United States, citizens and aliens alike, were declared entitled to have their liberty and their equality protected by the United States against state infringement. State bills of rights older than the Constitution, codes whose almost identical terms had tolerated slavery in Virginia and had commanded emancipation in Massachusetts, took second place to provisions in the National Charter, enforceable by the National Congress and the National Courts. Lingering notions of state supremacy, weeds watered by Madison and Jefferson and brought to flower by Calhoun and Jefferson Davis, seemed to have been uprooted. In their place, a new birth of freedom backed by new national authority. The shift from the parochialism of Buchanan to the national vision of Lincoln, the shift that took a war and fundamental amendments of the Constitution to accomplish, was, however, more than a deepening of national commitment to human values and more than a relegation of the states to secondary political consequence. It also augured a deeper understanding of the positive uses of government, both state and national, as instruments to enlarge the common welfare. It is no coincidence, I suggest to you, that the adoption of the 13th and 14th Amendments and the establishment of the University of Illinois were contemporaneous processes. This state university was born of federal land-grant legislation. In this company, it is proper for us to recall that the Morrill Land-Grant Act of 1862 was not only the inspiration of Justin Morrill, the Vermont congressman whom the legislation immortalized, but also it owed much to that sturdy and visionary son of Yale, Jonathan Baldwin Turner, the Illinois professor farmer who, both metaphorically and in fact, laid the cornerstone of this university. But the fact deserving of special emphasis is that Morrill's bill, the land-grant bill, when first considered by Congress back in 1858 and 1859, ran into very heavy fire from the chauvinists of states' rights. In the Senate, the fight was led by Senator Davis of Mississippi, Jefferson Davis, and Senator Clay of Alabama. What was the infamous scheme to which the senators were opposed? Now, the Morrill-Turner plan, I remind you, was to have Congress give public lands to the states. The proceeds from the sale of these lands were to endow state universities, which, and I quote to you from the legislation, quotes, without excluding other scientific and classical studies and including military tactics, were particularly, quotes, to teach such branches of learning as are related to agriculture and the mechanic arts in such manner as the legislatures of the states may respectively prescribe in order to promote the liberal and practical education of the industrial classes in the several pursuits and professions of life. To all of this, Senator Clay of Alabama took instructively vehement exception. The federal government is a creature of the states and is dependent upon them for its organization and operation. I stand as an ambassador of a sovereign state, no more subject to the control of the federal government, except in a few instances provided in the Constitution, than any foreign and independent state. This bill treats the states as agents instead of principals, as creatures instead of creators, and proposes to give them their own property and direct them how to use it. Notwithstanding these very cogent arguments, the Morrill bill narrowly passed both House and Senate, only to be vetoed by President Buchanan, who regarded the proposal as both mischievous and unconstitutional. But a year later, in 1860, candidate Lincoln, an unlettered man who had a larger view of the nation and of the states, met Jonathan Turner and assured him, "I will vote for your bill for state universities," a campaign pledge which candidate Douglas soon echoed. Because Lincoln redeemed that campaign pledge, and because he fulfilled his inaugural oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, we are met here this evening. Join a college, join the United States, Robert Frost admonished us. The establishment of untrammeled educational institutions, schools and colleges alike, and the establishment of free political institutions are common measures addressed to a single goal, the structuring of a community whose integrity derives from the self-respect and hence the mutual respect of the men and women and children who are its members. My purpose this evening is to talk briefly about the ways in which certain major constitutional developments of this past century have pointed the nation and the states toward this goal. I think it will appear that the Supreme Court's most fruitful and enduring definitions of the relationships and the strategies governing the political community have drawn upon and on occasion strengthened the models of the academic community which we profess allegiance to. I think it will also appear that a failure to preserve the freedom of either community would put the entire American experiment at hazard. And I suggest that the hazard is most acute when, as today, we are at war. First, I want to consider with you how the court has given meaning to the promise of equality. We begin with the court's flamboyant nihilism of 1857. The holdings in the Dred Scott case that slavery in the territories was beyond the power of Congress to curtail, and that a Negro, whether slave or free, could never be a citizen within the meaning of the Constitution. Lincoln, as he said at Alton, in the last of the great debates with Douglas, quotes, "believed the decision improperly made and went for reversing it." Douglas sought ambiguous middle ground, acquiescence in the decision, but a hint of readiness to subvert it in practice by declining to give requisite governmental protection to the asserted constitutional right to maintain slaves in the territories. But war, emancipation, and amendment ended debate and ended slavery, and seemed to usher in a new era in which all alike were citizens, were protected against the loss of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and were entitled to the equal protection of the laws. "What is this," the Supreme Court asked in 1880, "what is this but declaring that the law and the states shall be the same for the black as for the white? That all persons, whether colored or white, shall stand equal before the laws of the states, and in regard to the colored race, for whose protection the 14th Amendment was primarily designed, that no discrimination shall be made against them by law because of their color." Judges who posed this rhetorical question should have been able, 15 years later, to deal in a sensible and forthright way with the newly enacted Jim Crow laws, laws which, as C. Van Woodward, the greatest of Southern historians, has put it, backed up the Alabamian who told the disenfranchising convention of his state that no Negro in the world was the equal of the least, poorest, lowest down white man I ever knew. But not so. The Supreme Court, other than the elder Justice Harlan, found no constitutional infirmity in the Louisiana Jim Crow car law, which consigned Negroes and whites to equal but separate, that was the statutory language, equal but separate railroad cars, except, of course, for, and this was the statutory exception, nurses attending the children of the other race. The constitutional imperative of equality, the court found in Plessy versus Ferguson, gave way to any legislature's determination of, quotes, reasonableness. And in making that determination, legislators were, it turned out, quotes, at liberty to act with reference to the established usages, customs, and traditions of the people, Legislation, said the court, is powerless to eradicate racial instincts or to abolish distinctions based upon physical differences. And the attempt to do so can result only in accentuating the difficulties of the present situation. And in this way, the 14th Amendment was, until 13 years ago, withdrawn from application in the great bulk of the cases to which it was most precisely fitted. But the amendment didn't fall into disuse. As you will recall, the justices gave the amendment the opportunity to fulfill its obligation in other ways. Wherefore, the anomaly that until the late 1930s, the amendment did valiant service in striking down minimum wage and maximum hour laws and the like. Now, this constitutional aberration, vast as its consequences were, need not detain us this evening. What is worth considering is the way in which the 14th Amendment was restored to relevance in its area of prime concern, the realm of Jim Crow. For it was in the classroom, and especially in the great state universities, that the grotesquerie of separate but equal began to come apart at the seams. In 1950, the court considered two such cases. In one of these, Texas tried to persuade the Supreme Court that a Negro denied admission to the University of Texas Law School could learn law just as well at the shiny new law school, and I quote to you how the Supreme Court spoke of it, the new law school at the Texas State University for Negroes, which had a faculty of 5 full-time professors, a student body of 23, a library of some 16,500 volumes, and one alumnus who has become a member of the Texas Bar. But although white students at the old school clearly didn't enjoy the happy teacher-student and book-student ratios accorded black students at the new school, the 9 lawyers on the Supreme Court were unpersuaded. It is difficult to believe, they said, that one who had a free choice between these law schools would consider the question close. But another case, which the court considered at the same time, cut even deeper. G.W. McLaurin, Negro candidate for a doctorate in education, was admitted to the University of Oklahoma's Graduate School of Education, but under rather special circumstances, circumstances which the court examined in detail. For some time, the section of the classroom in which appellant sat was surrounded by a rail on which there was a sign stating, "Reserved for Colored." But these have been removed. He is now, said the court, 1950, assigned to a seat in the classroom in a row specified for colored students. He is assigned to a table in the library on the main floor, and he is permitted to eat at the same time in the cafeteria as other students, although here again he is assigned to a special table. These restrictions were obviously imposed, said the Supreme Court, in order to comply as nearly as could be with the statutory requirements of Oklahoma. But they signify that the state sets McLaurin apart from the other students. The result is that appellant is handicapped in his pursuit of effective graduate instruction. Such restrictions impair and inhibit his ability to study, to engage in discussions and exchange views with other students, and in general to learn his profession. Our society, said the court, grows increasingly complex, and our need for trained leaders increases correspondingly. Appellant's case represents perhaps the epitome of that need, for he is attempting to obtain an advanced degree in education, to become by definition a leader and trainer of others. Those who will come under his guidance and influence must be directly affected by the education he receives. It may be argued, said the court, that appellant will be in no better position when these restrictions are removed, for he may still be set apart from his fellow students. This we think irrelevant. There is a vast difference, a constitutional difference, between restrictions imposed by the state which prohibit the intellectual commingling of students and the refusal of individuals to commingle where the state presents no such bar. The removal of the state restrictions will not necessarily abate individual and group predilections, prejudices, and choices. But at the very least, the state will not be depriving appellant of the opportunity to secure acceptance by his fellow students on his own merits.
Thus, in 1950, the court found that Oklahoma had placed upon McLaurin, an adult pursuing graduate studies as a matter of his own choice, a stigma of unconstitutional dimension when it assigned him to a special classroom row and a special cafeteria table, which were, in all but written legend, quotes, reserved for colored. 4 years later, in 1954, the court could not, in doctrine or in conscience, deny the stigma when children required by the state to attend school were shunted by the state to school buildings reserved for colored. To separate them from others of similar age and qualifications solely because of their race, so the court held in Brown versus Board of Education, generates a feeling of inferiority as to their status in the community that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely ever to be undone. The nine justices who announced this inevitable truth were echoing, albeit perhaps some of them were unaware, cognate truths announced from the same bench, but with less than unanimity in earlier years. Particularly one thinks of Justice Frankfurter, concurring in the decision to overturn the ill-starred release time program of the Champaign Board of Education. The public school, wrote the justice, is at once the symbol of our democracy and the most pervasive means for achieving our common destiny. And particularly one thinks of Justice Brandeis, dissenting from the 1928 decision which sustained the constitutionality of wiretapping. Our government, wrote Brandeis, is the potent, the omnipresent teacher. For good or ill, it teaches the whole people by its example. The elimination of coerced race distinctions is only part of the problem of creating, in our political and in our educational community, the conditions of freedom. Subtler, but no less important than full acceptance of diverse colors, is full acceptance of diverse beliefs. It was this Justice Frankfurter and his concurring colleagues had in mind when they joined in upholding Vashti McCollum's challenge to Champaign's release time program, a program of optional religious instruction carried on by members of the clergy during school hours and on school premises. That a child is offered an alternative, wrote the justice, may reduce the constraint. It does not eliminate the operation of influence by the school in matters sacred to conscience and outside the school's domain. The law of imitation operates, continued the justice, and nonconformity is not an outstanding characteristic of children. The result is an obvious pressure upon children to attend. The children belonging to non-participating sects will thus have inculcated in them a feeling of separatism when the school should be the training ground for habits of community, or they will have religious instruction in a faith which is not that of their parents. These are consequences, wrote Frankfurter, not amenable to statistics, but they are precisely the consequences against which the Constitution was directed when it prohibited the government common to all from becoming embroiled, however innocently, in the destructive religious conflicts of which the history of even this country records some dark pages. Surely the justice's perception is what really underlay the opinions rendered after his retirement and lacking, it is fair to say, his clarity of statement, which struck down prayers in public schools. What is perhaps the court's most forceful statement of the conditions of freedom which must prevail in a public school was made in a case, West Virginia State Board of Education versus Barnett. Decided in 1943, amidst all the pressures for national conformity, which are the inevitable concomitant of war. Barnett was a case in which the majority of the court, rejecting its own prior holdings, struck down a required schoolroom flag salute at the behest of Jehovah's Witnesses for whom obeisance to the flag was profanation of the deity. Justice Jackson spoke for the court. Free public education, he wrote, if faithful to the ideal of secular instruction and political neutrality, will not be partisan of, or enemy of any class, creed, party, or faction. Probably no deeper division of our people could proceed from any provocation, said Jackson, than from finding it necessary to choose what doctrine and whose program public educational officials shall compel youth to unite in embracing. It seems trite but necessary to say that the First Amendment to our Constitution was designed to avoid these ends by avoiding these beginnings. I suggested near the outset of my remarks that in a democracy, the political and academic communities operate under similar ground rules for common ends. To illustrate these ground rules, I have sampled two sets of problems which the court, the potent, the omnipresent teacher, has explored within the framework of the public school and the public university. But I have said little of the common ends. Perhaps two examples will sufficiently indicate what I have in mind. One spring afternoon, some 3 years ago, Lawrence Paquin and I were hurrying along Orange Street in downtown New Haven. Dr. Paquin, at that time our school superintendent, and now the school superintendent in Baltimore, was very excited, but it was not, I hasten to add, about the school board meeting we were about to be late to. He was excited about what was going on in the basement of the Dixwell Community House, where our school system had launched a pilot program to give preschool children an advanced taste of school life, a prototype of what was to become Head Start. On one wall of that basement room, someone had had the wit to hang a full-length mirror. Most of the children spent much of their time peering into that mirror. For the first time in their lives, they were seeing themselves. They were not nobody, and they were not Dick and Jane. They were their own proper selves. About a year before, in 1963, the Supreme Court reviewed a case arising in Alabama. The petitioner was a young Negro woman who'd brought a habeas corpus conviction in a state court to challenge the validity of a prior conviction. She testified in her own behalf. On cross-examination, the following took place. What is your name, please? Miss Mary Hamilton. Mary, I believe you were arrested. Who were you arrested by?
My name is Miss Hamilton. Please address me correctly.
Who were you arrested by, Mary?
I will not answer a question,
her attorney interrupted. The witness's name is Miss Hamilton.
Your question until I am addressed correctly.
The court.
Answer the question.
I will not answer them unless I am addressed correctly. You are in contempt of court.
Your Honor,
you are in contempt of court and you are sentenced to 5 days in jail and a $50 fine. The Supreme Court reversed Miss Hamilton's contempt conviction. The court's opinion consisted of one case citation, a case which had held that racial segregation of a courtroom was unconstitutional. What did this laconic opinion mean? It meant, I submit, that Miss Hamilton had an identity, that she was an American woman entitled to be perceived in her individuality. To say that the academic and political communities have common goals is not, of course, to say that their functions are interchangeable. Indeed, one of the chief responsibilities of citizens, not only the citizens who happen to be judges, is to maintain the vital separation of these communities. As President Henry put it so eloquently a decade ago, I believe, said the President, that the public school system, including the colleges and universities, provides cohesiveness in American life. Schools are the neutral ground where partisans on all other issues, religious, economic, political, social, may join in a common effort for furthering the public welfare. Public education, said President Henry, belongs to all the people, all the time, and must therefore have political immunity and complete social understanding and support. What President Henry said means, for example, that it was essential that the school board in Burlington, Connecticut, rebuff, as it did 2 weeks ago, the demand of a mother and father that their daughter's eighth grade school teacher be required to desist from assigning in her English class, assigning Harper Lee's novel To Kill a Mockingbird. Likewise, it means that the Campbell County School Board in Tennessee must be called upon to recede from its absurd decision of a couple of weeks ago to fire a school teacher for teaching evolution in ludicrous emulation of the Scopes farce of four decades ago. And don't be deceived into thinking that the proposal which is now before the Tennessee legislature, which would modify the old so-called monkey law by permitting evolution to be taught as a theory, but not as a fact, represents some significant advance in Tennessee's thinking. The important fact is that Tennessee's Senate has just rebuffed the most recent attempt to repeal the monkey law, to wipe it off the books entirely. The climactic speech in that debate was that of a senator from McMinnville, Tennessee. According to the New York Times, Senator Ernest Crouch read a letter from a soldier in Vietnam whose life, he said, had been saved by a bullet striking a Bible in his pocket. That argument, said Senator Crouch, our children can't be educated because we can't teach them the theory of evolution is a ridiculous statement. We know the greatest book ever written, the Bible, tells us where life came from and how God created man.